Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. Since 2009, HRN podcasts have been exploring the wide world of food, beverage, and agriculture. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org.
This episode is brought to you by Roberta's, home of Heritage Radio Network for 10 years. Learn more about Roberta's at robertaspizza.com.
We talk about food. We talk about music with musical dudes. Finger on the pulse. Snacky Tunes.
Hello, welcome to Snacky Tunes. I'm your host, Aaron Bresnitz. Thank you to everyone who subscribed to the very first issue of the Snacky Tunes newsletter. We are excited for the support, and the goal is to come out with a new issue every other week. And if you want to sign up, just go to snackytunes.substack.com. This week, I'm going from Deep East Side to Deep West Side to chat with Zara Khan, the new-ish executive chef over at one of our favorite restaurants, Rustic Canyon. She talks about cooking dinner for her family as a teenager, the first time she met Chef Jeremy Fox, and her time as a self-proclaimed Seattle pizza rat. Then we head into the archives, into 2018, for an experimental performance from Coleman Zerkowski, which was recorded live at Dangerbird Records Studios in Silver Lake. He plays some songs off his debut album, Zero, and chats about how he made a name for himself working with such brands as Netflix, Toyota, and LeBron James' uninterrupted documentary series. So please sit back, relax, and enjoy Snacky Tunes here on Heritage Radio Network. Zara, thank you so much for taking time to chat with us and taking time out of your schedule. Welcome to Snacky Tunes. We're so happy to have you here.
Thank you for having me. I'm happy to be here.
Congratulations, Executive Chef Rustic Canyon. I know it's been a few months, but how does it feel to be overseeing one of the most legendary restaurants in LA?
It feels kind of crazy. I think day to day, you're like so in it that I like forget most of the time. I'm just like focused on making sure that, like, you know, stations are staffed and food is right, and you know, I'm working on dishes and stuff. So yeah, it's like normal chef stuff. And then you do an interview and you're like, oh yeah, or you like go out to eat, which is pretty rare for me. But then I remember sort of my place in the world, and it's like kind of scary, but also kind of awesome.
Yeah, when the comp from the back start filling up the table, you're like, right. I want to go back a little bit. Grew up in Seattle. Was food a big part of your childhood? What do you, you know, who cooked? What was eating like growing up?
My parents were they were like 24. I'm a twin. So they were 24 when they had us.
And I am also a twin.
Oh my God. Crazy.
Identical?
Wow. Yeah.
Same.
Do you guys live in the same city?
No, we don't. We don't. Okay, but yeah, do identical twins. That's another interview. We can talk off afterwards.
That's for the twin podcast.
Yeah. So you're an identical twin growing up in Seattle. Your parents were 24 when they had you.
Yes. So they were very much sort of like learning to cook when we were kids. And my mom, but like we still would have like barbecues all the time. Like my parents would hang out with their friends and have barbecues. So that was a big thing. And my mom's best friend is Syrian. And so like there was always like hummus and tabbouleh and like, I don't know, like the Horia Tiki salad and falafel. And so some of the things like that I still love and make, I grew up eating. And then a lot of it is sort of just, I think of it as sort of an exploration of my heritage. But when we were in middle school, my parents asked my sister and I to each cook dinner for the family one day a week. So that's, I think, when it really started. And like, there was a lot of like tuna niçoise salads, but like,
Hey, it's still like, dinner. That's still dinner in my book.
I was like, it checks all the food groups. We're good.
We got greens. We got a protein. We got a nice little fat with the dressing.
Exactly.
And so your mother's Pakistani, your father was German, and you're talking about salad niçoise, which is French. So were you cooking food from their cultures, or were you like, I want white bread, I want PB&J, I want hamburgers, you know, like, because you said you did barbecue. So how much were you embracing what they were cooking, and how much were you saying, like, I want American food?
Oh, my God, I am not an American food person, really. Like, we grew up as, like, very adventurous eaters. I've been pescatarian for like 17 years now. So like hamburger, I'm not even tempted by. But yeah, I think we are mostly, I don't know. We just were always into sort of like weird random food. I remember like going to school and having like my friends be like, that's what you're eating. Or like my first boyfriend ever came over for dinner and he was like, do you guys always eat like this? And we're like, so yeah.
That not so insulting, but also sort of like, so this is how you eat.
Exactly.
And it's like, let me see what you eat, Mr. Hamburger Helper, you know?
Exactly.
So when you got thrown into the kitchen at a young age, and all jokes aside of the salad niçoise, did you realize that that was not as common as other teenager experience, having to put food up on the table? And or you're like, this is just what we do in our family, and it was sort of just normal?
I feel like it was sort of normal. I think my parents were always like, I don't care what so-and-so is doing. This is what we're doing. So that's just what we did. And I really didn't think about this until a couple years ago, because like I've gotten the question of like, how did you get into cooking? Like, a decent amount. And I used to always be like, oh, in college, blah, blah, blah. But really, it was in high school when we were doing this. And then all of my hangouts with my friends would be like, if it wasn't like sports related, it was like, just come over. Like, I have this weird idea. Like, just hang out with me in the kitchen while I make this thing. And that was like what I would do. Which is so weird thinking back, but like, that's how I have been forever.
I think it's weird thinking back now, maybe a little less so with like TikTok and how popular food has gotten, but the idea of cooking for your friends as an activity and it not be something like, we're going to make mac and cheese or I'm going to bake some box brownies, but you're going to make it from scratch. Yeah. You start to see how that's fundamental because you started working in kitchens as a teenager, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
So did you get that bug where you're like, oh, like I'm missing at home. Like I'm like, you know, this is great, mom and dad, but I got more chops than, you know, Friday night, you know, nice piece of fish.
Yeah. I mean, I remember getting mad at my mom once because she made like Moroccan, like tagine. And I was like such a brat. And I was like, there's not enough vegetables.
Oh yeah. Like, the classic and I was like, teenager fight of right? not enough vegetables, the tagine. Tales all the time.
What a cliche.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I didn't even think about it like that because I think, like you said, because there wasn't like TikTok and like yeah. even Instagram back then. So I was just like in my own little, I don't know, world.
But it's one thing to cook for your parents at home and your sister, and it's another thing to get into a kitchen, especially at such a young age. And you always get to get your parents' approval. Oh, I don't know what labor laws were like in Seattle at the time, but assuming your parents had to sign off on that. Yeah. What, you know, it's what made you make that jump? And I'm not, because that's not even like a, oh, I'm going to be a professional chef, or maybe you were already thinking about that.
Oh my God, definitely not. I was not thinking about that. I think it was really like my parents always pushed us to like have a job. Like we always were like in school and doing sports and playing music and like, you know, you should probably have a job. And I wasn't like the biggest fan of babysitting. So,
sure.
My mom also had a friend who had this little Moroccan cafe down the street called Treed. And I started there as a dishwasher at like 13. And I would like go in and wash dishes and like bus tables basically, and then walk home with like a wad of cash in my pocket. And I was like,
yeah,
it was hard. I mean, she was like this really intense Moroccan lady who would like make me chop onions, and I'd be like crying. And I was like, I don't like this. And then, yeah. And then, I don't know, there's something about it once you get, because it was so small and there wasn't the sort of like camaraderie that we think of when we think of kitchens. But like once I had my sort of first taste of that, I was like, okay, like this is pretty much it. And this is how my brain works. So
yeah. Once you get, I mean, look, you get to be out with the people who have always loved the people who work in restaurants. You put a little money in your pocket, especially at a young age, it's enticing.
Oh, totally.
Now, skipping forward a little bit, because I know that you cooked all the way through college, and you became, and I've never heard this term, a self-proclaimed pizza rat, which I would love to know, how does one become one, and what is one?
Oh, man. Well, this was, like, in college. I was working at this, like, wood-fired pizza place that did, like, farmers markets and catering,
sure,
really.
Sure.
And I feel like there's, it's like this subsect within the like industry that's just like pizza rat. Like,
yeah. Okay.
Like, I don't know. I just feel like it's very much a snapshot of my youth of like biking everywhere and like going to shows and like sneaking into bars and like being covered in flour and just like, you're just kind of, I mean, I still sort of identify as a dirtbag, but like, you're just, pizza is such a like, it's sort of like this focused field, but it's also so sort of like punk rock at the same time.
How much cheap American light beer were you crushing at this time?
Oh my God. I wasn't, not really. I was like into sours. Seattle, like, I don't know.
It's a pizza rat with a refined palate. Yes. Mm-hmm. We will not be drinking that swill.
Yeah.
What has kept you in the profession this so long? Because, I mean, look, it's, you know, and we're going to get to Rustic Canyon in a little bit, but you're going on, you know, a decades plus starting at a young age. Most time people, like, they burn out or they find a different thing. Is it the people, the stories, like, the system? Like, what is it that keeps you in?
I think the older I get in the industry, the more it's about community and, like, less about honestly anything else. I think that that's the most beautiful thing, and especially coming out of the pandemic, like, from the operations in the back, like backside of it, to like what restaurants are from like a diner perspective. I think it's such an important part of our human lives, kind of. And so that's what I love about it. And there are moments when you're like, you know, racing through the kitchen, like yelling in Spanish, and the music is on, and it's just like, I mean, obviously there's adrenaline there, right? But like,
you're alive. It's
yeah,
alive.
You're alive. Yeah. And then when someone like asks to meet me or whatever, and I get to come back into the kitchen and be like, compliments, compliments. They said this nice thing. I'm like, this is the result of an effort by a lot of people. And I think that's really beautiful.
It's beautiful. No, I love it. I love it. I love it. All right, we're gonna take a quick musical break, and then we're gonna talk about your kismet like meeting with Jeremy Fox, and then winding up your way to LA and East Side versus West Side, and cooking for the people who live across town. We have a song from the archives here on Snacky Tunes on Heritage Radio Network.
Don't.
Welcome back to Snacky Tunes. We're with Zara Khan, executive chef of Rustic Canyon. And you graduated college. You're pizza ratting around town with a refined palate. All due respect. But you're also working in a lot of incredible Seattle restaurants. And you're super deep in the scene. And I think as far as cities that have good relationships with their farmers and have sort of a kinship to LA and like the West Side, Seattle is definitely one of them. What was the scene like, and when did you start gravitating to or actively like farm to table or working with purveyors, like that type of cooking versus just, you know, a different type of high end type of restaurant style?
Well, when I graduated college, I was like, cool, I've like checked that box and like, here I go. And I started working at Hot Cakes, which Autumn Martin owned. I think she sold it now. She has, Frankie and Joe's, which is like a vegan ice cream spot. So I was like in pastry, and her sourcing has just always been impeccable. She like cares about all the things that I care about. And so that was like very informative. And you kind of sometimes like don't realize how good you have it until you leave, and then you like stodge around and you're like, oh, people don't care about this. Like, how could you not care about organic cane sugar or like whatever? So, and she got her start like doing that at farmers markets. So that was sort of where it began. And then I left there and was at Poppy with Jerry Tronfeld, who like is a legend and who obviously also cared a lot about sourcing. And I think just coming from like my environmental studies and like ecosystem resource management background in college, I like always cared about that. And I feel very like lucky that I've been able to sort of like carve this path for myself where I was able to source the way that I wanted to, or that I felt passionately about.
So obviously you need to work at a restaurant that also wants to make that investment, because it is a lot of work. It's a lot of work. And in some ways it's gotten easier and it's more accepted. And when you have a community that buys into that, that eats there, they're like willing to pay a little bit more, or know that like, sorry, just no tomatoes tonight. I don't know what to tell you, because it's, you know, not the right season. How did you start finding the restaurants, or did you start thinking about actively searching out the places you wanted to work, or even start running kitchens? Did you have to say no to some places that weren't up to what you wanted to do food wise?
I don't really think I said, well, I think I just really like dug into the places that I wanted to be at and like made a spot for myself there. Like, I mean, when I was at London Plain, I started there and I was like farming part-time and line cooking part-time. And I was like, okay, wait, there's too much manual labor. Like, I need to choose one. But yeah, I've always just sort of like picked a spot and been like, that's the place where, you know, there's like a level of respect that I have for that, for those people that I've worked going in. I would never really, I'm like one of those people who's like, my soul will like die. I can't work at a place or cook food that I don't believe in. So
Now, it was also during this time when you're still in Seattle that you met Chef Jeremy Fox of Rustic Canyon. What was the first meeting like? Were you like, I'm going to follow you? You know, what do you remember of your first interaction? How did you two meet?
Well, I had obviously idolized him for a long time, and my GM in Seattle had known him from when they were both working in the Bay. And I was a sous chef at the time, and I remember I was really pissed in this moment. We had done this like dinner and the pastry chef. Anyway, I was pissed in this moment, and my GM was like, let's talk about shit. My GM was like, just check your email. And I was like, okay, fine. And I checked it, and there was this like beautiful email from Chef Fox being like, you know, Yasu introduced, like, you know, sent this email, and like, you're welcome to come stage at Rustic anytime. And I was like, oh, holy shit. I'm still mad about this thing, but like, thank you.
But silver lining. I'm still mad.
Exactly. And so I flew down on like my birthday, when my 30th birthday, to stage at Rustic Canyon. And Chef Fox was at Birdie's, because he had just opened Birdie G's. And I flew in and had dinner at there with my friend, and he was like running the path like from the outside, and I was like, oh my god, like there he is, like that. And I like didn't say anything until after our meal because I was just like too nervous. And I don't know. And he was like, I wish you had told me sooner, I would have like sent more stuff. And I was like, no,
it's fine.
Yeah. So I like, that was a really brief meeting, and then I like spent 2 days staging at Rustic and then flew home.
So you eventually made your way to LA and started working on the east side, deep in the heart of Silver Lake at Botanica, which for anyone who lives here is like one of the new, hipper, always packed eateries / marketplaces. Mm-hmm. How did you wind up there? And then now that you're coming to a different city, but also an established restaurant, how'd you put your own spin on it, but keeping the regulars coming in?
Well, I ended up there because I had eaten lunch there on the trip that I had staged at Rustic at. Mm. And I was like, okay, like, this is sick. My friend Emily, who's a chef up in Seattle, is like friends with one of the owners. So I'd like known about it, and I was like, I want to check this place out. And I just thought it was like excellent and beautiful. And yeah. So I ended up there, and I moved down March 8th of 2020, and I was like, do I still have a job? Like, what?
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. And I think I feel really weirdly fortunate because like that place was like 7 days a week, lunch and dinner. And then I started, and it was pandemic, and it was like only market and then only dinner and then like only takeout, you know, it was like this whole dance we all did. But it was only dinner and 5 days a week for like, I would say at least half the time I was there, which I think was like really nice because it allowed me to sort of focus on the menu and the food and like, you know, staffing up. And so it felt very much sort of like opening a new restaurant. But in terms of like keeping the regulars, like Emily, Heather, and I don't think I've ever met people that are more aligned with me food wise, like just coming in. So I was really lucky coming in that like they already like fuck with my food, and we could have conversations and like get like agree on things really well. But I think to their like credit, I think it's probably incredibly hard to open a business and not be the chef, and then like but have very strong perspectives and be excellent cooks themselves, like to try and find a chef to run it in the way that you want it to be run. I feel like we all felt very lucky to have found each other.
Especially during, you know, such a, I don't know, I don't even know what the words are anymore. Just like the craziest time, and the restaurant industry changing as a whole, and you know, so many great spots just closed forever, not for anything other than just being such a tenuous business.
Totally.
So you're cooking there, and what in the back of your mind kept Rustic Canyon on the burner? How did that keep percolating, if you will?
Well, I wasn't even really thinking about it. So when we started to staff up again at Botanica, I was called Boti, so I just thought myself at Boti. I was just struggling. I was like going through a lot personally and trying to staff up and having a hard time. And so I just reached out to Chef Fox and one of my other friends in Seattle who's a chef, just to ask for like leadership advice. And Chef Fox wrote me back this like beautiful, I don't know, like DM, and was like really kind and like took the time. And then was also like, I've been wanting to come in and eat your food for my birthday. Like, can you make me a reservation? And I was like, yeah. So then he and Rachel, his wife, came in for his birthday, and he loved everything and like blew me up on Instagram, which was very nice. And then they came in again, like, I don't know, a month or so later. And then we did an event together for like Resi and Annex, which was crazy. And then, so we were like in touch. And then he literally just called me up one day and was like, I wanted to run something by you. And I, like, in my weird head, I was like, we both love Astro Diner. Like, he's going to have to take over Astro Diner with him. I don't know. And he was
by,
like,
the way, not the worst thing in the, not the worst thing in the world.
No, I was like, I don't know why I thought that, but yeah, but he was like, Andy's moving on and you're the first person I thought of. And what do you think?
Wow.
And I was like, what?
What?
Yeah.
Did you say what? You're like, what was, because most people don't get asked to take over or be handed the keys to keep stewarding it. In that moment, what did you feel? What were you thinking?
Like, honestly, and like I said this to Chef Fox, I was like, I had just gotten my team at Botanica to like a, like I really was like, everyone's solid and like really loved everyone who was there. And like my sous chef who's like with me at Rustic was with me there. And I was like, why would I leave? Like, I have, you know, these are, it's like so good. It's like always been something that's like so good and it's like running smoothly and blah, blah, blah. And it was really an incredibly hard like thing to leave that team because I wasn't looking to leave at all.
No.
But, you know, but then it's like it sinks in and you're like, oh, holy shit. Like, Jerry Fox has asked me to do this thing. Like, yeah. I'm not going to say no. Like,
No, you're not. So, as the executive chef, you're coming in and, you know, there are obviously staples at Rustic Canyon, but and you need to always keep adding and improving, and but you can't have people been coming there for over a decade and not get the pizzole. You know what I mean? Or something that they consider to themselves untouchable, as in it can never be removed from the menu. So how did you balance keeping the ship going, making your own thing, versus adding your own take on it? And did you see a difference in the same way coming from Botanica with the East Side Silver Lake diners and like the West Side Santa Monica diners?
Oh my God, no, they're so different. I mean, I think definitely like Botanica is a different platform for sure.
And sure.
Like the food they were doing was already much more in line with my food in a way, like in terms of style. Sourcing, obviously, at the two of them is the same level of consideration and responsibility, I guess. But yeah, I mean, like, Andy's style is so different than mine. And yeah, so it was a little bit of a slow thing. Like, I remember, like, the first couple weeks, Chef Fox was like, are you happy with the plating of this stuff? And I was like, it's so weird to come in and be like, I'm running expo on this food that's not mine. Like,
yeah,
you know, you just hit the ground running. And I was like, I've never done that. I've never like taken over a restaurant, like at full speed from like coming in. So I was like, I don't know, like not really, but like, it's not my food yet.
Yeah. It's not my plate.
Yeah. But then you just sort of start slowly and like you sort of like attack the weak points in my, like, I don't want to say weak points, but just like the points that are not people's like staple things. Like it's taken me a minute to like change the pasta. And then I just recently had a conversation with Josh, the owner, and he was like, you don't have to have a pasta on the menu. But like, first I needed to like change the ranking because pasta was like number one seller every fucking day. And now it's not because like sweet potatoes have like upstaged it.
Oh, so, man. Like, what a rivalry. The rivalry is tails all this time. Yeah.
Carb rivalry.
Yeah. So, yeah. Yeah.
It's sort of like you have to build a leg before you take the other leg out. So it's a bit of a puzzle piece. And sometimes it's like stressful because you're like, I want to change this thing, but like three other things have to change for that to make sense. So it's really just like, yeah, you're sort of Tetrising the menu a bit. And especially like for my style of food coming into Rustic, like you sort of have to like be a little gentle and like let people get comfortable with you a bit. But then there's also part of me that's just like, let's just fucking kick the door down. Like, let's go.
So have you settled in? Do you feel a few months in now that you've gone that you're like, I feel good. I feel that this was the right decision.
Yeah. I think that point probably came like, honestly, a month ago where like, I think I was able to lift my head up and be like, okay. And then probably like, a week or two later, my sous chef was also feeling the same way. And I definitely came out of it a little bit first. And now we have this moment like this week where he found this menu from October 29th, which was our fourth day there. And we had one dish on the menu. And we were like, holy shit, that feels like a year ago. Like, that was so intense. Yeah. And, like, you know, like, the whole team flipped, and now it's all, like, our team, and I redesigned the menu, and, like, formatting-wise, and all, there's, like, the beef and berries is still on the menu. It changed it a tiny bit. But everything else, except for the honeycomb and, like, the lavender almonds, obviously, is mine. And so that feels cool, and just like the amount of energy it took to like put my first thing on the menu versus like now when things are like, you know, in flow is like, yeah, it feels good. And there's still like obviously so much more that I want to do. And
and how have the regulars reacted and embraced it? Or some people have been like, where's my pasta?
Pasta's still there, it's just different. but good. I think there's like it's a much sort of, you know, Santa Monica is definitely a different crowd. The age, the median age is definitely older than it is in on the east side over there. But I think for the most part, people have been really about it I feel like every night I'm like, tell me the feedback. And like, sometimes you get somebody that like doesn't like something, but for the most part, people like it. And I'm hoping that the clientele continues to like shift and, you know, cause it's kind of like, you have to do you, and the people who are into it will come. And if they're not, then they won't come. But like, all you can do as a creative person is like put pieces of yourself out there. You can't like perform for people something that's not you. So I'm just like, I fuck with it and the team is excited, then the people who fuck with it will come. And I'm not so worried about like trying to please everybody.
No. I mean, how can you? So before we go, I want to touch on one last thing you're working on, because festival season is here in LA. And I know you're going to be heading out to the desert, a.k.a. Coachella. which weekend are you going out for Outstanding in the Field?
It's this coming Friday.
Okay. So this is going to air the Sunday after you've done the event, because we're talking on the Monday before. Okay. It's a great event. I've done the long table out in the field. Very weird to like come off out of a tent and be like, I'm going to go have a tasting menu.
Yeah.
But it was awesome. I was like, oh, great. Not like another slice of spicy pie. How are you prepping? What are you cooking? Have you ever done anything like this at a music festival before?
Oh my God. No, never. Chef Fox is like, this is my nightmare. And I'm like, it's going to be an adventure.
It's going to be lit. Chef Fox.
He's not coming. I'm sure he's very stoked. He's not have to be there. This is definitely the most people that we've cooked for, but I have a lot of spreadsheets and a lot of lists and just prepping for like 250 people. It's a really simple, it's like four courses, so it's not nothing crazy, and just like, yeah, sort of like lining them up and then knocking them down. And when we get there, my goal is to just be like, everything is like 90% of the way there and we're just executing. And I have like a lot of wonderful people helping me, so I'm very like honored that they wanted to come and take the time and do this. And it should just be like fun and like nourishing and healthy. Yeah.
I mean, look, if there's one thing that people need during festival weekend, it's some vegetables. Like, put some nutrients in that body. That isn't like a added flavor to White Claw.
Oh my God. Have I ever had White Claw.
I know, you and me both. But that's, oh man. Well, listen, Zara, I cannot thank you enough. If people want to come check out what you're doing and fuck with your food, where can they go? How can they get a seat at the table?
I think it's like through the Outstanding in the Field website, there's a link to it. And yeah, it'll be at the VIP like Rose Garden on Friday, the 14th.
Nice. And if people want to come by the restaurant, how do they get a table?
Book through Resy. You know, Rustic Canyon, Santa Monica. Make the trek to the west side if you live on the east side.
Yeah. It's worth the trek. 7 days a week. Always worth the trek. Well, thank you so much. Thanks to Lisa as well for setting this up. And congratulations on everything. We have a song from the archives and then a live performance here on Snacky Tunes on Heritage Radio Network.
This episode is brought to you by Roberta's, home of Heritage Radio Network for 10 years. Roberta's was founded in Bushwick in 2008 and has become one of the most iconic restaurants in the country. HRN made its home inside of Roberta's in 2009, and together they have become part of the DIY fabric of the neighborhood. Roberta's, the pizza restaurant, is open for lunch and dinner 7 days a week and serves much more than just the famous wood-fired pizzas. Their team dreams up new salads, pastas, and sandwiches on the regular. Roberta's Tiki Bar is alive and well in the back garden, serving up frozen drinks in the summer and hot toddies in the winter. Stop by the bakery and takeout spot next door for fresh breads, sticky buns, and pizzas to go. And of course, there's the 2-Michelin-starred Blanca tucked away in the garden for truly daring diners. But Roberta's also extends beyond Bushwick, with multiple locations in New York City and now in Los Angeles. You can also find their frozen pies in grocery stores around the country. The spirit of Roberta's, like Heritage Radio Network, is everywhere. Here's to many more years of pizza-powered radio.
Coming this spring, we're working on something big for opening soon.
Opening a restaurant can sometimes take months or even years.
So I have this one consulting client that's been 3 months away from opening for the past year.
And I had a calendar reminder show up today, and the reminder was that our goal was to open tomorrow.
But this spring, you'll be able to hear it in just a few hours.
On March 30th, he had passed away, and then on March 31st, he had come back to life. And then on April 2nd, he had passed away again. And I was like, okay, my regards to the family. I don't even know how to receive this information.
So tune in as we follow one of Brooklyn's best and brightest young chefs and restaurateurs on their journey from start to open doors.
Alex, you need to put more money in. We're out. We can't pay anybody.
He is the worst. Oh my God, that guy.
It's The Build.
Subscribe to Opening Soon from Heritage Radio Network, wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hello and welcome back to Snacky Tunes. I'm one half your host, Darren Bresnitz. We are sitting in the legendary Dangerbird Record Studios in gorgeous Silver Lake. And we are joined by the illustrious Coleman Zerkowski and Matt Lau from Brooklyn on the West Coast. Welcome to the Tunes. How you guys doing?
Fantastic. How are you, Darren?
I am good. I'm good. How was the show last night?
The show was incredible. I could say a lot more, but it was really...
We're going to get into it. Okay, we're going to talk about the show. We're going to set up. That was just a pleasantry.
Yeah, definitely. Incredible.
So you're East Coast born and raised, born in Baltimore?
Yes.
Baltimore has a legendary sort of avant-garde music scene.
Well aware.
That's what I'm getting to. How did that influence you growing up? Did you go to a lot of the shows, like, you know...
Yeah,
What is it, Otto's Bar?
Yeah. That's a cool question because I've never really considered that ever, because when I was in Baltimore, it was age 0 to 18, and a lot of that was being in bands. But I remember my high school, there was a teacher there who was very involved in the experimental music scene in Baltimore. His name was Mr. Wojo. And there was a...
I mean, if that isn't a Baltimore band name, I don't know what is.
And so there we had a... when the tsunami in... It was a hurricane relief concert. There was like a benefit concert. And...
For Japan?
No, I think it was in...
Or a hurricane.
What was it in 2000?
You mean Sandy?
No. I'm sorry. This is unrelated, but it was the one in like 2005, 2006 in
Thailand,
Indonesia.
Thailand. Okay.
Regardless, but we shouldn't be disrespectful of it. But
yes,
we had a benefit concert, and this guy played the benefit concert, and he was a teacher. He was like a philosophy Harvard scholar, and he did this concert where he wrapped himself in Christmas lights and was just screaming into a microphone.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
With an upright bassist and just like feedback, and I was just totally blown away because I was 15 years old and I thought it was the most insane thing I've ever seen. Everybody hated it, but now that I think about it, I think that's had a huge influence on just thinking outside the box in terms of music.
Well, I mean, you also have guys like Dan Deacon.
Yeah,
who,
of course. Yeah.
To me, sort of speaks to your music, which is taking this electronic vibe and bass, but then also having a bit more like larger orchestrated sort of like scoring in what you've been doing as well.
Yeah.
And I think that just gets, that seeps in.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and I actually didn't even know Dan Deacon until I, or know of Dan Deacon until I went to college and I left Baltimore. And I remember thinking, oh my gosh, I can't believe I missed out on all this music when I lived in Maryland. But I would still say it's just, I think what is true is that that culture is very present there. There's a very outside the box culture. I mean, John Waters, that has also been a huge influence as an artist too.
Yeah, I mean, Baltimore's got a lot of art, a lot of heart. Mm-hmm. Definitely the most fervent fans of a city of people who live there, but
yes,
also this like underdog,
so
like balance.
Yeah.
So then, what brought you to New York?
Well, so I grew up in Baltimore, went to college in Chicago for my undergrad at DePaul University.
Mm. Chicago, another great music.
Yeah.
More Midwest heart, though. I mean, yeah. To me, that's like the Braid, indie rock, Captain Jazz.
Yeah.
Sort of like
definitely
meat and potatoes. But also the Joan, but that also is like the Joan of Arc weirdness as well.
Yeah, but I would say that was more like the people around me. I mean, I played in like, I played in a black metal band. And I also played in just punk and black metal bands, but I was studying classical music in school, and I think that was, both of those have had a huge influence on my music.
I mean, that's pretty amazing to have, be studying that, but then also, was that a unique situation where you were playing in these black metal punk bands and things like that, and a classical, was anyone else in your class like that?
No, not really, and actually that's what I felt like when I was in school, like, you know,
Oh, you're dropping your R's on the weekend.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. I'd be like inviting people to my shows and they'd be like, I thought you made a different kind of music. You know? I'd be like screaming in a microphone. But again, I think it's all just music that's outside of the box. And another important influence from Chicago is the hip hop scene in Chicago.
Huge.
Very, and it's very, very present. And when I was there, I got really into
Juke, right?
Juke and footwork.
Yeah.
I got into that after I left Chicago and I was like, I can't believe I didn't know this in Chicago.
They're like, oh, you went to these shows. You're like, if you can't check, then yes.
Yeah, 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 exactly.
But also Baltimore and Chicago, two great food cities.
Exactly. I was gonna get to that too. So if we're gonna talk about food, especially on the show, I mean Baltimore, the food there is like, every time anybody's like, oh, you're from Baltimore, I just say Old Bay, and then they're like, oh my gosh, I love it.
I mean,
Old Bay.
Of the best meals I've ever had.
The crabs, like
I took the bus down from New York.
Mm-hmm.
And I was DJing at Otto's Bar.
Mm-hmm.
And went to a Bricky's before.
Mm-hmm.
Before it closed.
Yeah.
Did the whole like mallet crabs on the table. And but now there's only one location, and it's like at the airport. It's like
Weird. Well, there's plenty of crab places, and actually every summer my family and a lot of people have crab sort of feasts where like we just get a bushel of crabs and all crack them open. But the thing is, it's amazing to, I grew up knowing how to eat a crab, and it's insane to know that people, that's like so crazy to people, is to break open a crab and pull all the meat out and all the mustard, and
it's pretty visceral.
Yeah.
And I remember my parents, we were in Seattle up in Pike's Place in the market.
Uh-huh.
And they taught me how to do that at a young age. And all my friends who love food are into it. But you put somebody, it's like a classical kid at a punk show.
Yeah, yeah.
You know
exactly
what I mean?
Exactly.
You're like, I thought my crab comes in a can.
Yeah, exactly.
All right, well, let's get into a song. And then we'll talk a little bit more about your move to New York and some of like the commercial work you've done, because there's
sure
good stuff there. What are you going to play for us first?
Should we talk about the song a little bit?
Yeah, set it up.
So this is a piece from the album that I released through Dangerbird Records in February. The album is called Zero. And each track on the album is a number counting down from 9 all the way to 0.
That's awesome.
So the first track is 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0. And the album is a really deep exploration of, one, sound moving into silence, but also a rhythmic pattern that's going very very slowly slowing down.
Mm.
And so maybe
so you have to listen in order.
Yeah, exactly. You can listen out of order, but the album has a full effect if you listen to it from front to back.
Love it.
And the one thing I want to say to listen for in this is there's a rhythm in one of the organ parts that's constantly going, and that's supposed to sort of like lock you into listening to it, as well as it's an exploration of how one thing could continue to repeat and how if you change one element, how that could affect how it sounds. So well, maybe think about that.
Let's get into it. Which track is this?
This is 7.
Awesome. Well, here we go. Coleman Zerkowski with Matt Lau here on Snacky Tunes on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. awesome.
That was a really good performance too. That was sweet.
Thank you for showing up.
Yeah.
No, I appreciate it. So living in New York, in addition to making your own music, you've also been doing some commercial work.
Yeah.
Which is really interesting because as a composer, someone does scoring, you have a chance to create original works of music. They're not just licensing songs, correct?
Right, right.
So, you know, sometimes commercial work gets a bad name, but we also know that that is what allows you to sometimes do the artistic stuff.
Absolutely, absolutely.
So what sort of freedom, like what sort of things do you love about the commercial work that you maybe you don't find in making your own music? Is there a certain freedom there?
Yeah, I could talk about this for a while because I think...
Great, because we have some time to fill.
But in the art world, I think commercial music gets... It has this constant bad rap, which is just like, oh, it's so shallow. It's so... It's like, why even waste your time with that? It's not expressing anything. And to be honest, my favorite part about commercial music is that it doesn't express anything from me at all. In fact, commercial work is like a craft. It's you need this track that matches this visual. Make that track, and then you get notes and do revisions. And personally, I love it because it's distancing myself. I think in art, sometimes your ego can get too involved with with your work. And the best part about commercial music for me is that I can completely remove myself. And there have been many, many times when I've had commercials, and the thing about commercial work, particularly like advertisement, it has to be done like within a... I've done gigs where like they called me at 11 p.m. and they need a track by 8 a.m. tomorrow, and I have to write Yeah, exactly. I have to write 3 to 5 tracks by 8 a.m., which is typical. That's actually very standard. And sometimes if I'm forced into a situation where I have to write music, it gets the wheels turning in a way that, like, if I was just sitting at the piano waiting for inspiration, wouldn't happen in the same way.
Like, there's no way if you were working on your own project, you would be like, I'm going to start at 11.
Right.
Stay up till 8.
Right.
Crank out 5 songs.
Exactly. No, no way. And it's like, because that pressure, but again, I feel like the brain works where it's like, you're still using the same tools, but you're just not expressing yourself creatively, which is another element of the brain, I would imagine. And so, like I said, it just gets the wheels turning, and I love it. I think it's a blast.
Now, you got to work on a Three Musketeers commercial.
Oh, yeah. That's one of my top singles.
Yeah, number one?
Yeah. I think the Toyota one's the number
that
one.
That Three Musketeers thing. That
it's a good track, though.
Put a couple of rooms in this house.
Yeah. No, that one, it's not that it really paid well, but it was just, I was so proud of it. Like, that was a... I wish everybody could see when I was writing that in my bedroom. It's like,
were you eating the Three? Did you like go out to like the bodega and get a couple of Three?
I wish for inspiration. No, not quite.
So
it's a good track, though.
It is a good track. It's a good. The next.
First, it's called single, Winter Morning, by the way. The track.
First single off. Do you get to name them?
Yeah. You have to. They always have to be sort of like cheesy names that imply the emotion of the. So anytime I write it, I just think of the first thing, and I was like, Winter Morning.
Right. So like when it gets nominated, they see the name, and they're like, oh my God, like what a perfect track.
So beautiful.
So what would you say to someone, because it seems like you're very comfortable in commercial work.
Yeah.
Like maybe framing it as like a way to support the artistic work.
Like, absolutely.
Like what advice would you give to someone who is like, hey, first off, lucky enough to get that phone call at 11 p.m.
Right, right, you know what I exactly. mean?
Like, it's hard enough to get that type of work. So, like, what would you say to someone?
I think my entry into that is actually pretty valuable, like, as a story. I went to school at CalArts for my master's degree.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason I came out here was I was interested in two things. I was interested in experimental and classical music, as well as breaking into the film and commercial world. And in my second year, I started doing internships for a lot of music houses, and things weren't really going well for me. I did 3 internships that were just completely dead ends. And one of them, I won't say which, but one of them I was sexually harassed at. And
really?
Yeah. That's a juicy story. I don't know if it's appropriate for the podcast.
We'll get into it later.
But anyway, just a very, very terrible experience to the point where I never actually felt like I wanted to do music for any sort of profit again. And I didn't feel like music was a career after that. And so I got into restaurants, and I was like a busboy, and I got fired from a restaurant for eating a Brussels sprout. And then I got fired from a coffee shop job because I wouldn't wash my shirt. I had coffee stains all over it. I wore it every day.
Wow.
And they let me go and they said, honestly, the reason we let you go is because you didn't wash your shirt. But I can't blame them. You know, that's probably me being irresponsible.
That is your line in the sand. It's an odd line, but it's your line. So yeah. Who am I to judge?
Yeah. So it's like, yeah, I'm talking about all these places that let me go. Maybe it's a me issue and not an everybody else issue. But anyway, after that, everything sort of coalesced. There was this commercial editing company that I had always wanted to work for, and I had a friend that worked for them. I had one interview with them, and then I had read on Forbes.com. I don't know if you know Forbes.
Oh, yeah.
But Forbes.com said, if you want to get a job, you need to be persistent. So I kind of took that to the next level, and I emailed them once a month for 9 months. And I said, like, hey, is there still a job open? Hey, how are you? There was one I was like, hey, I hope you guys are like, I talked about the Super Bowl. But then they weren't responding. So I felt I had this like liberty to start
you're like,
making them a little
wild.
More interesting. So
just skip forward to month 9 email.
Yeah, yeah. The last one I sent was, hey, I just wanted, because I always thought it'd be like cool to be funny on email, but I just like didn't really take into account how it would turn out. But I said, you know, if you guys need any hand, like if you want me to like wipe down the keyboards, give you a foot or back massage, like take out the trash, feed you, put the food in your mouth, and then just like all this weird personal stuff. And then the person emails me back, are you available? And then so I ended up going in for an interview, and they're like, honestly, you just seem like such a like weird, like cool person that we wanted you to work with us. And like, we just thought you were really funny. I wouldn't necessarily recommend that because I probably lost me some jobs too.
the persistence is the takeaway.
So hold on, if you don't mind me finishing
the story.
So I go in for an interview. I start out as the coffee guy, and it was actually kind of rough at first because I have a master's degree in music, and here I am serving coffee to advertising clients, and I felt very undervalued and just lame. I'm in there like, oh, I got your cappuccinos, but it's very typical for Los Angeles to be doing this, you know. So I'm doing this every day, and then there was this one commercial, and I kept being like, you know, I do music, I would love to do music. And they're like, well, we don't need music, we're an editing company, we don't need music. Mm-hmm. They're a video editing company. So I walked into this room, and I said, I drop off the coffees, and I'm about to walk out, and I hear this guy, he's one of the advertising clients, he said, I just wish there was somebody that could write this track, but like do it for cheap.
Oh my God. Is your Hollywood moment.
Exactly. Exactly. I was like, this is it, you know? So I turn around and I was like, you know, I could write the track. I write music. They're like, no, I'm sorry. We need a professional. And I walk out of there. And this one,
no.
Yeah. Well, I walk out and I remember exactly. I was washing the dishes and I was like, it's really not going to turn out well for me. I'm thinking to myself, like, here I am. I just put myself out there. And it's just never going to happen. And a guy comes out of the room and he's like, you have your master's in music, right? And I was like, yeah. And he's like, I mean, why not give you a shot? It's like, you could do this. And if we could do it for cheap, I mean, we'll do it for cheap, but if you want to write something, like, we have nothing to lose. So I was like, okay. And it ended up being they wanted a Bernard Herrmann track. You know Bernard Herrmann?
Mm-mm.
He did all the music for Alfred Hitchcock's films. And I love his music. And I just, everything had been leading up to me preparing for this moment. So I took it home, and it was. I got home at 8 p.m. that night, and I delivered the track. It was a 30-second track for an NBC commercial the next morning. Totally just knocked it out of the park. Like I put my whole life into that thing.
Is that the CISA stuff?
Yeah. And so I brought it into work the next day, and they were just completely floored. I wasn't in the room, but I was told from multiple people that people's mouths just dropped. And it's because it's like, that's what I do, you know? And it's like, I believe if you get yourself in an element where you do what you enjoy doing and have fun, then people respond to that.
I'm just going to say this because it needs to be on the record. Hands down, one of the most inspirational stories I've heard on this radio show. Oh,
cool.
The emails, the persistence, the putting yourself out there.
Yeah.
Let's hear another song.
Oh.
Ooh, that was a good story.
Cool.
On the record. That's the story you send to your mom.
Yeah. No, I mean, I will say about my parents, they gave me such a hard time about studying music, and they're like, why don't you get a real job? Or, you know, they considered me getting another degree. And then as soon as I got that commercial, they're like, we told you would make it.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, well, we got some words for off the air. So what do we got now?
So, not to say, I love my parents, by the way.
Oh my God, of course. I love my parents too.
This is another track from Zero. It's a percussion piece. And same idea is to think about rhythm changing.
Okay, and what's the title? Which track?
Oh, I'm sorry, it's Five.
Perfect. All right, here we go. Live on Snacky Tunes on heritageradionetwork.org. Coleman Zerkowski with Matt Lau, Dangerbird Record Studios. Yeah. Ferocious. So you're out here to celebrate the film score turned album for the Project Zero, which was put out on Arthur King Presents. Shout out to Arthur King.
Yes.
And this is part of your opus of film scoring. And you've done a bunch of composing and things like that. You did for Netflix and things like that.
Yeah. This is, I will say this is a little different. This album was a flip of the script. It was an album first and then became a film.
Very nice.
Yeah.
Way to inspire.
Yeah.
Real flip of the script.
Yeah.
What approach do you take when scoring a film? Is it a little bit more of a mix of the commercial work versus artistic stuff? Because you got to pull in, it's like more of a collaboration, or is it like, hey, we have a scene?
Well, actually, that's why I made Zero, is that as much as filmmakers, film is much more of a creative realm than commercial work. Like, commercial is very much like a craft.
Yeah. No, yeah. Films, exactly 30 seconds.
Yeah, exactly.
Although one could say that commercials are mini films.
There are people that believe that. Yeah, I mean, yeah. But films are, there's a lot more creative freedom. But people never seemed, at least with music, a lot of filmmakers I found in my experience never take the liberty to have it be as collaborative, because a lot of filmmakers have a vision. They want to see that vision. And so a lot of films that I've done will be like, hey, I want this song from this movie, and I want that song, and I want that song, but I can't buy them. Can you make something that sounds like them? Ooh. Or it'll be a scene that's like, you know, I want this emotion, I want this feeling. But a lot of it is like reference tracks. And so what I wanted to do is I wanted to make something where film and music were on the same plane, where it was much more of a collaborative thing, but also like the billing is the same. It's not, because film, it's always the director is the main person.
Sure.
You know, a Wes Anderson film, a Gus Van Sant film. But I wanted this to be
director of Godzilla.
What's that?
Terrible joke.
But I wanted this to be something where composer and filmmaker are on complete equal plane, and you're experiencing film and music all at once, instead of just, because any, most of the time in film too, it's like there's a visual and music is enhancing the visual.
Sure.
And I wanted this to be an experience you get all at once.
But I mean, I feel like some of the best films, the music just elevates it.
Yeah.
To a whole other level.
Yeah.
I mean, all, I would say, the best scenes and movies, it goes without saying, or needs to be said, I would then.
Yeah.
They have the best soundtracks.
Well, and I'm sure a lot would agree with this, but a huge inspiration for me musically has been 2001 Space Odyssey as a film.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, the last sequence of that film, I saw that, and that was a big inspiration for Zero, is that you get to a point where you're just listening to music and looking at visuals. It's actually like totally what I wish Zero could do. And there's like no dialogue. There's no nothing for what, however long that end sequence is. Yeah. It's like 15 minutes long. It's awesome.
Yeah, which was revolutionary.
Yeah.
And so with the release of this, are you taking it out? Like, are you going to play it like sequentially, like 9 through 0 out as a show? Or like, how do you perform something that's written for the album? We're supposed to listen to it in a very specific way, and then translating it live.
Well, so also making a film was a logistical thing too, because there's a lot of musicians involved in the album. There's probably like 20 musicians involved. And so I wanted to tour this thing, but I didn't know how to get 20 people, or I didn't have the money to afford 20 people to move around with me. So I made it into a film because that could be easily spread as far as possible.
Of course.
So this year, last night was actually the last show of this self-funded tour that I did, which I went to, basically I reached out to all my friends in as many cities as I knew, and some in Europe, some here, and just whatever I could afford a plane ticket, I would go, we would organize a show, and I would screen the film and usually do some sort of performance or just introducing the film. I feel like in art, people respond if they just know your personality. And a lot of it was just going out there and being like, hi, I'm Coleman Zerkowski. If you want to talk afterwards, we can. And then presenting the film. And it's had a really great impact. Or not impact, but a really great result. And I
say impact.
Okay.
Don't undersell yourself.
I mean, I just think a lot of good has come out of it, i.e. this Danger Bird thing.
Yeah.
And Danger Bird pushed me to do the live thing, which I was really originally against, but then it's been really, really
those,
great.
Those guys are the kings of video and music.
Yeah, and it's awesome.
It's awesome. Well, I want to make sure we have enough time for one more song. But if people,
yeah, I'm sorry for talking.
Don't apologize.
I love apologizing.
Oh, my God. Yeah, we definitely are have Hungarian background. Apologize all the time.
Are you a hypochondriac, too?
Not a hypochondriac, but a lot of things are my fault.
Okay.
Until they're not, then I'm like, it's your fault. So where can people enjoy the film? Where can people listen to the music? Where can people get the album?
So the album is definitely available on Spotify, iTunes, and Amazon, and YouTube as well. And I just did a self-funded vinyl release of the album, but there's only 100 copies. And that's going to be available on my Bandcamp, ColemanZerkowski.bandcamp.com, relatively soon.
Awesome.
So keep a lookout for that. But also, I'm trying to keep the film offline as long as possible until hopefully somebody else uploads it. I don't want to put it online. But if you purchase the vinyl, it comes with a DVD of the film.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
And stay tuned for more Arthur King Presents, because they have some cool things in the pipeline.
Definitely.
What's the website? What's the Instagram? Where can people go to see you online?
So ColemanZurkowski.com is the website.
You want to spell that?
ColemanZurkowski.com
Thank you. Thank you for that last part, too.
Definitely, definitely. And then my Instagram is at DJ Versace, but Versace is spelled V-E-R-S-A-C-I.
Oh.
Yeah.
How'd you get that?
When I actually lived in Los Angeles, I performed a lot of shows as DJ Versace. I thought it'd be funny if I moved to Los Angeles and became like a DJ named DJ Versace, and then I actually did it. And but I'm kind of dropping that now, but it's still my Instagram name.
Love it. Okay, great. Well, what's the last song we're going to hear?
The last song is actually, I wanted to share a piece that's not from Zero.
All good.
I was originally going to share... something from the upcoming album. I'm working on an upcoming album that hopefully will be available. Not available, but be performing and sort of out in the world around January. And I thought that could be like a good lead-in, but you know what? I'm going to switch it up. I'm going to play something older.
Ooh.
This is a piece that I wrote in 2013 called Die von Blumen reich ich dir, which is the last line of a poem in German. And it's the last line is, those of flowers are for you. And I think what I want to say about this is, I had written this a long time ago and then sort of didn't do anything with it, but I wrote it because I was really inspired by this pianist in the Netherlands named Dante Boone. Mm-hmm. And I wrote this piece, and I said, hey, look, I wrote this piece inspired by your concert. And he tours a lot, and he's a really good pianist. And he appreciated me being inspired by him so much that he performed it in Dusseldorf in 2016. And after that performance, he also performed another composer's piece who I became friends with in New York and is now Matt and I's boss. So this piece that I'm about to play is literally responsible for me surviving in New York right now.
That's amazing. Well, Coleman, it's been great to hear
Darren, stories. It's been awesome. Thank you for having us on here.
Thank you so much, Matt. You too. Dangerbird, thank you as always. Thank you for listening to Snacky Tunes. We'll be back next week. Here we go. One last performance here on heritageradionetwork.org.
Thank you, everybody. Enjoy.
We talk about food, we talk about music, with musical dudes, finger on the pulse, Snacky Tunes.
Snacky Tunes is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. Keep in touch at heritageradionetwork.org/subscribe.
Hi listeners, we want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Awaili, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.